Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Having enlisted Jordan's help with Grievous's quest, Carla decides to see how the youth is coming with that project. Chapter 23. Carla braced herself as she leapt into the pool, knowing what was coming. The water was ice cold and clear as glass, squeezing a yelp out of her as she dropped below the surface, letting the water soak her hair. Then with a splutter, she bounded back to the side of the pool, reaching for the soap.
"One reason you folk get so much done," she said between clenched teeth, "is that you don't spend a second more in the bath than you have to."
Sister Miriam and the two other female monks in the room with her laughed.
"It's quite bracing, I'll grant you," said Miriam, briskly toweling off.
"The cold water sharpens the mind for the day's challenges," one of the other monks pronounced as she climbed out,
but Carla saw how quickly the woman reached for a towel herself.
"Couldn't you figure out a way to get some hot water in here?" Carla asked Sister Miriam,
scrubbing herself down with quick, shaking strokes.
"You're an architect, aren't you?"
"Among other things," the monk agreed. "On some cold mornings, I've imagined renovations to pipe hot water through the bathhouse."
"Haven't we all?"
the third monk said, dropping into the water behind Carla.
"But you're right," Miriam went on. "We would rather be about the Father's work than linger in a warm bath."
Her smile turned wistful.
"I must confess, the last time I was in Trevon, the innkeeper prepared a bath for me, and I did not object to him heating the tub."
Both of the other monks laughed.
"Ah, so that's the reason you want to go on that research trip," said one of them.
Miriam's smile widened as she sighed, shaking her head. Then she knelt down next to Carla and handed her a small glass vial.
"Use a few drops of this to wash your hair instead of the soap."
The liquid inside the vial was a viscous amber gel with tiny bubbles trapped within. Carla worked it into her hair, producing a thick lather.
"That's good," Miriam said. "Now rinse."
Carla dropped below the water again and shook her hair out, letting the pool's current carry the bubbles away. Despite the water's chill, Carla was still amazed at the ingenuity of the bathhouse every time she came here. The bathing pool, as it was called, was more of a stream to her mind. A tiled trough about 5 feet across and 20 feet in length, the monks had diverted a portion of the underground river up into the bathhouse and through this narrow channel. Bathers entered the pool at the far end and moved against the current as they cleaned themselves, the soap and dirt carried off through a grill to rejoin the river somewhere underground. Wick had told her that the setup was similar on the men's side of the bathhouse.
"It's a tight squeeze in the mornings, though," he had said after their first breakfast. "We jump in one after the other and have to move along in a quick line. Feels a bit like I'm back in the barracks, to be honest."
This made Carla glad the bathhouse was segregated by gender. With fewer women at the Abbey, her mornings were more companionable than crowded. The layout of the bathhouse reminded her of the Abbey's church. The central room had a large blue banner hanging in the middle of the far wall from floor to ceiling, while the archways leading to the male and female bathing areas were marked with red and green banners, respectively. She wasn't familiar enough with customs of the triad clergy to know if this separation of genders was common practice, or if it was a custom solely of the Abbey, another way for the monks to avoid unnecessary temptation.
"This water's so cold, I don't know how anyone would want to stay naked long enough to provide temptation," she thought, as she walked the last few feet to the end of the channel, teeth chattering.
Dunking her head one last time to be sure Miriam's cleansing liquid was out of her hair, she scrambled up the short ladder and wrapped a thick towel around herself. Miriam waited for her, watching as Carla squeezed the water out of her hair and wrapped it in a second towel. The other monk that had been ahead of Carla in the bath had already left.
"Another reason we keep our hair short," Miriam commented. "It's one less thing to do before getting on with the day."
"I see your point," Carla replied. "I might cut it short for a change someday, but I'm still enjoying it as it is."
Once her hair was tightly wrapped, she handed the vial back to Miriam.
"Thank you for letting me try that. My hair feels softer already."
"A little extravagance of my own," Miriam confessed.
"One of the sisters here found the formula in a book from Al-Kef.
Apparently, it was developed for the daughters of a particular sultan to keep their hair smooth and free of tangles.
Well, if it's good enough for Kefi nobility, it's good enough for us, Kerla laughed.
Is it easy to make?
Relatively. It involves a bit of brewing and stewing, but I can certainly get you a copy of the formula.
How much longer will you be with us?
A few more days at least. Thank you.
Not at all, Miriam replied, leading Kerla down the short hallway to the dressing room. This was a much wider space than the bathing chamber, with wooden cubby holes set against all four walls and down the center of the room, bisecting it into two squares. Miriam and Kerla sat down on the low bench near the cubby holes, holding their clothes and personal effects, and began to get dressed.
You don't have to wait for me, Kerla yawned as Miriam cinched her rope belt about her waist.
Sorry, I'm moving a little slow this morning. Brother Hallam invited me up to the observatory for stargazing last night.
The monk smiled as she nodded.
Yes, it was very clear last night. Excellent conditions for seeing. I've been up there myself on a few occasions. Brother Hallam conducts lectures from time to time. The stars are very beautiful, but it often makes the next morning harder. Have a good day, my friend. May today's work bring you closer to the Father's design.
The same to you, Kerla called after her, tugging one of her boots on.
She yawned again, shivering once more. It was warmer in here than the bathing room, but it wasn't warm enough for Kerla's tastes. She looked forward to feeling the sun against her skin.
There must be a spell to warm up quickly, she mused. Then she gave a rueful chuckle. Of course, if I got it wrong, like as not I'd incinerate myself.
Except to renew the illusion that made her appear human, she had not thought about magic very much the past few days. There had been so much else requiring her attention. But the monk's enthusiasm for learning was inspiring, even infectious. She recognized that enthusiasm in herself when she was practicing a new spell.
Could I be happy here, she wondered, if I hadn't met Teska, if I hadn't sworn service to his grace?
She smiled.
Maybe, at least for a while. Living here, studying magic the way Hallam studies the stars?
Her smile faded. Except stargazing isn't a danger to others. An image flashed into her mind of brown robes wrapped around withered corpses, and her next shiver had nothing to do with the cool air. But despite her dread, she knew there was no escaping the truth. She needed to investigate that spell she'd cast during the battle with the Li Rouge. She had to know what had gone wrong, if only to ensure that such a mistake never happened again. And there were other reasons as well. Grievous's words came back to her. Any ship you are on becomes the most powerful in the Freeze.
That's no hollow boast, she realized. If I could figure out how to reliably keep the mana from interfering with gunpowder, the Cutlass would have nothing to fear from any ship north of the Quad, not even a Sabrian frigate. And as the mana continues to expand further south...
She could sense deep implications from this discovery, rumbling in the future like the thunder of an approaching storm. But it was too remote and nebulous for her to fully grasp.
If Galen was here, he'd see the entire problem in one heartbeat and know what to do in the next.
She sighed.
Well, when I get home with Jordan, I can have that conversation. For now, I've just got to put some thought into what exactly happened during the battle. The news that magic and gunpowder can be used together doesn't do His Grace much good if it can't be done consistently.
She pulled on her second boot and looked around the dressing room. The room was nearly empty, with only a few monks still coming in to bathe. The rest have headed to breakfast by now, she realized. The idea of food appealed to her as much as warm sunlight did, but she lingered, mulling over something that had piqued her curiosity since last night. What were Drusus and that monk coming in here for after curfew? She smirked. Someone who hasn't endured a bath here might jump to a more personal conclusion, but once you've been in that water, all you really want is to get your clothes back on as quickly as possible. It's something else, she decided, standing up. These folk are scholars, not hedonists. Their passion is for learning, and the way Grievous described him, Drusus is cut from the same cloth. So, if Drusus is slipping away in the middle of the night with one of the monks here, they must be pursuing knowledge of some sort. Something secret.
Then she paused.
Something forbidden? In a place like this, what sort of knowledge would be forbidden? I don't think that's the sort of question I could just throw out to Brother Hollum.
Frowning, she started toward the dressing room exit, but then she paused, her eye caught by a gleam of red. Looking in one of the cubbyholes, she saw the folded clothes in there weren't the brown robes of a monk, but were instead a white linen shirt, dark breeches, and a pair of leather boots. Sitting on top of the shirt was a pair of earrings and a matching necklace, made of gold and set with small rubies.
So that's what she's been wearing, Carla thought, examining the jewelry. It's really beautiful.
She leaned closer to take a better look, and frowned when she saw all three pieces had a styled F in the center of the design.
That looks familiar. Where have I seen that before?
Like them, do you? Came Allie's voice directly behind her.
Carla whirled to see the fane woman regarding her from a few feet away, dripping wet, her torso and hair wrapped in towels, as hers had been only a minute ago.
They're very pretty, Carla admitted, flustered at being caught off guard. How in the hells does she move so quietly?
I'm surprised you leave them out like that.
No one here to take them, Allie replied. She gave Carla a slow smile.
Well, except one. You've always been fond of red gems, haven't you?
Carla bit back a reply, looking Allie up and down with a scowl. She was in better shape than Carla had expected, her curves delineated by well-toned muscles. Then she noticed the ridged white scar on Allie's left shoulder. It began at her clavicle, curling over the bone and continuing up, arcing out of sight.
Where'd you get that? Carla asked, realizing that whenever she'd seen Allie wearing something that left her shoulders bare, she had draped her hair over that scar or had a scarf wrapped loosely about her neck to conceal it.
Now it was Allie's turn to scowl.
A duel on Narlos? With Tesca?
You fought a duel against Tesca?
Allie rolled her eyes.
He was my second, you idiot. Tesca and I only crossed blades for practice.
A bitter, mocking smile flitted across her lips.
We settled our disagreements in other ways.
Carla refused to be drawn into that discussion.
Keep her off balance.
Did Benato find anything interesting in here last night?
Allie's smile shifted to a puzzled frown.
What are you talking about?
Oh, so he's doing it without your knowledge? Carla said, smiling. Last night I saw Benato sneaking in here after curfew.
What were you doing out of doors after curfew yourself? Allie demanded.
Stargazing with Brother Hollum. I looked over the edge of the observatory and saw him crossing the lawn to the bathhouse.
She pointed to her own eyes.
These see all at night.
Allie remained silent, knowing Carla's boast was accurate.
It must be hard having a traveling companion you can't trust.
This did not elicit the reaction Carla had expected. Instead, Allie gave her a mocking grin.
Benato's a liar, a sneak, and slippery as a greased eel, so I know better than to turn my back on him. But I'd rather have him around than Grievous. Grievous makes you believe in him, makes you feel he's watching your back.
She leaned over Carla, reaching past her into the cubbyhole.
And that's when he'll slip the knife in, dear. Just wait.
Carla took a step back as Allie set her jewelry on the bench. Then, letting her towel fall to the floor, she drew her small clothes from the cubbyhole and began to get dressed.
Thank you for the information about Benato, Allie went on. I'm not feeling disposed to owing you any debts, however, so I'll offer you a piece of information in return if you'll confirm one final detail for me.
All right, Carla replied, curious.
Was Benato following someone?
Allie gave a knowing smile when Carla nodded.
Was it that other Sabrian, Drusus?
It was, Carla said. I take it you know why.
Not precisely, Allie said, sitting on the bench to pull her breeches on. Drusus was already here when we arrived, and Benato's been very curious about why.
Grievous is the same way, Carla said. I gather that Drusus has something of a reputation in the Empire.
Allie smiled at her.
When Grievous and Benato came to their disagreement over the disposition of the map, Benato went looking for people from Grievous's past, trying to find something he might use against our dear Caius. He found those two captains who had helped Grievous bring down Old Rex, for example, and we both know how that worked out.
One of those captains dead, and Grievous leaving the Empire in disgrace, Carla said. I know that Grievous once hired Drusus to do some research for him. Did Benato talk to him as well?
He tried, but couldn't find him. It's clear now that Drusus had already started work for a new client and was on his way to the Abbey well before our dear Caius killed his fellow captain.
Allie rose from the bench and turned back to the cubbyhole, reaching for her shirt.
He did manage to find out who hired Drusus, though.
She looked back over her shoulder at Carla.
Fleet Captain Livia Mauritius.
Her smile widened as she saw Carla's reaction.
That thickens the mix a bit, doesn't it? Oh, you're just dying to tell that to the old spider. There's nothing Galen loves more than a good puzzle, a fresh thread to weave into his webs. Maybe you'll get a pat on the head and a treat for telling him.
Carla smiled. Allie, if you're trying to get a rise out of me, you're going to need some new material. The Fane heiress laughed as she buttoned up her shirt.
I'll think of something after I've had breakfast.
I'm heading that way if you want some company. Allie shrugged, tucking her shirt into her breeches.
Why not? It's so dangerous on that path from here to the dining hall. How safe I'll be with a trusted servant of his grace at my side.
She took the towel off her head and shook out her hair, tying it back loosely with a leather thong, and after putting on her jewelry, she and Carla left the dressing room together. Carla squinted against the glare of the morning sun as they stepped outside, letting her eyes become accustomed to the light, but the sun's warmth was a welcome change from the chill of the bathhouse. Then she paused, hearing a faint sound some distance away.
Do you hear that? Sounds like cheering. It's those bloody pilgrims, Allie said with a scornful sigh.
She too had paused outside the bathhouse, savoring the warm morning air.
Most every morning you can hear them shouting and chanting outside the gate, begging to be let inside. But every once in a while they go crazy like this, screaming and crying like the daughter herself appeared among them. Sounds like they've had another of their miracles during the night. Some fool who thinks he's been healed or saved or whatever they're here for.
I take it you're not convinced they're really miracles.
Allie shrugged. The monks keep going out there to see for themselves, but the pilgrims won't let them get close to these so-called blessed. I've met plenty of folk asking me to invest in their miracle cure for this or that, but they're never willing to show me how their pill or their swill actually works, or what it's made of. It's a secret recipe, they tell me, or it's herbs that only grow on one small island I was marooned on for 10 years. She laughed. I've had 2 different people use that line on me. You want my money? You show me what you're selling. Anyone who doesn't is hiding something.
Carla had to agree with that. She didn't like the Fanes, but she had to admit they hadn't amassed their wealth by being stupid.
So, she said to Allie, if you didn't put the bounty on my head, who did?
The Fane woman paused, looking down at her.
And why would I tell you something like that if I knew?
We've already done 1 trade this morning, Carla said. Why not 2? Make me an offer. Allie pursed her lips, thinking.
I have a few ideas, she mused. I suppose I could share them with you. All right. If you find out what Drusus is working on before I do, cut me in on that, and we've a deal.
Done, Carla replied. They crossed the courtyard in silence after that, the far-off roars and cheers of the pilgrims ebbing and flowing, reminding her of crashing surf against a cliff. When they entered the dining hall, Allie nodded once to Carla and turned aside without a word, heading toward a table where Benato was waiting for her. On nearly the opposite side of the room sat Grievous, Wick, and Clegg.
Are my old eyes failing me, or did I see you talking with Mistress Fane?
Grievous asked as Carla slid onto the bench next to him.
You did, Carla agreed. We crossed paths in the bathhouse. No reason we can't be civil while we're here. I did learn a few things you might find interesting, however.
Then she told them about seeing Drusus and the unknown monk entering the bathhouse last night, and that they were being followed by Benato.
Allie didn't know what Drusus was up to, Carla finished, but she did tell me Benato knows who Drusus is working for. Livia Mauritius.
Grievous's eyes flared wide at the news, then his gaze dropped down to the table as he silently absorbed the information. Wick was puzzled.
"I know that name. From the Fett. Wasn't she the one who Master Sicari..."
"Fought a duel over," Kerla finished. "Well, he fought her son, actually. Almost killed him as well, but Teska chose to spare her son's life at the end. That's her."
"Oh," said Clegg, "that's the duel you were telling me about back on the Cutlass. A fight over his clothes, wasn't it?"
he added, nodding at Grievous.
"Still, seems she sent this fellow Drusus pretty far, just to poke around a few old books."
"Depends on which books they are," Kerla said, "and it's not as far as you might think, actually. She's fleet captain for Nauticus." Clegg gave a low whistle, then glanced at Grievous.
"You have any idea what she'd send him up here for?"
Grievous made no reply for several seconds, lost in thought. Finally, he raised his head, his face an expressionless mask.
"No, but I too would be curious to know what books he has been reading here."
"Well, as it happens, Jordan's the one who's been bringing those to him," Kerla replied. "He said they were a lot of different subjects, and often rather old. I could ask him to give me a more specific list."
"Please do," Grievous replied. "Can he do this discreetly?"
"I think so. I've already got him looking up something for us," Kerla said with a sly smile. "He's checking the Abbey Registry for the name Strabo to see if the man really came here when he rode out of Mypore." Wick and Clegg both looked impressed, but Grievous was not.
"You have done this without consulting me?" the old Sabrian said in a shocked hiss. "You shared details of our undertaking with this boy? A boy who is clearly love-struck by that fiend woman?"
"He's not as love-struck as it might seem," Kerla assured him, surprised at Grievous's flare of anger, "and he wants to help."
"Why?" Grievous demanded. "What assurance do you have that he will not go running to her with anything he might find?"
"Because what he wants is something Allie can't give him," Kerla threw back. "He wants an interview with you." She plunged on before Grievous could reply. "If people come here to do research but can't meet the Abbey's price, they often give an interview to the monks, telling of their discoveries and travels in exchange for some access to the archives. The Duke's paid for you to be here, Allie's paying for Benato, and now we know who's paid for Drusus, so none of you Sabrians have to give an interview if you don't want to. But if Captain Strabo came here with questions, how would he pay for those answers?"
Grievous considered this, eventually giving her a grudging nod.
"Of course. I am ashamed that I did not think of the registry myself."
He raised a finger and gave Kerla a stern look.
"But I am not pleased with you putting so much trust in this callow youth whom we barely know."
"Look," Kerla went on, "Jordan's fascinated by the Empire, and neither Drusus nor Benato have been willing to talk to him about it. His price seemed reasonable. And if we had asked the monks to check the registry for that name, how long would it have taken to get the answer?"
Grievous sighed, rubbing his temple as if he was feeling a headache coming on.
"Very well, I will answer the lad's questions, but only after he has completed his task. And if Captain Strabo did give an interview, then I must read the transcript as well. That is not negotiable. And I will expect our young scholar to have his questions prepared in advance. I have had my fill of nervous students shuffling frantically through their notes and squeaking out their questions like frightened mice."
"I'm sure he won't have a problem with that," Kerla promised, keeping a smile off her face. When breakfast arrived, the four of them ate with little conversation, each lost in thought. When the meal was done, they parted, Grievous and Wick heading up to Highgate to resume Grievous's study of the Preservatory's maps, and Kerla with Clegg toward Lowgate.
"You expect to find your young man down here?"
Clegg asked Kerla as they passed through the middle gate. "Well, he's supposed to be helping in the stables this week," Kerla said. "I figured I'd start looking for him there. And he's not my young man," she added sharply, which only elicited a leering chuckle from the cook. "I'm near twice his age, remember?"
"You say that like it's a problem," Clegg replied. "Trust me, at that age, men are far easier to handle. They know what they want, but haven't the slightest idea how to get it. So they're apt to follow directions a lot better than old dogs like me."
He started to laugh,
Train them young. That's the trick. And they'll never know to complain later.
Carla rolled her eyes. Oh, Triad's mercy. That is not what all this is about.
Isn't it? Clegg asked. Girl, you jumped off your horse to save him from that sword priest not 2 minutes after seeing him. He was pretty enough before his nose was cracked, I suppose, and since then you've mentioned that boy's name at least once in near every conversation we've had.
Carla stopped in her tracks at that. Clegg grinned.
Didn't even notice, did you? I've known you longer than them other two, my dear, and you've never talked that way about any man before. You shared a cabin with the left hand, and you kissed Giacomo in front of the whole crew, but you didn't chatter on about either of them this way, and you certainly didn't invent reasons to go looking for him.
That's not... Carla began, but then she broke off. I trust Clegg with my life, she realized, but not Jordan's. She bit her lip. That obvious, huh? Clegg laughed.
Let me put it this way. Even that thick brick you call your bodyguards noticed, and to be honest, he's more than a little jealous.
Wick! She stared at Clegg, wondering if the cook was putting her on. No, not Wick. Clegg shrugged and threw up his hands.
Have it your way, lass. You're the left hand. You know best.
He looked toward Lowgate's buildings.
Think I'll start with the greenhouses and ask about some of the herbs they're using in their food, then see if they need a hand in there. I'll find a spot with a good view of the main gate so I can keep an eye out for the Fane girl.
He sniffed the air and pointed in another direction.
In case you were wondering, the stable's over there.
He's joking, Carla decided, watching the cook amble away, laughing. He's always looking for ways to get under someone's skin. This is his latest attempt to get under mine. Wick doesn't think of me that way. But doubts lingered as she approached the stable. Damn you, Clegg! There were two monks and two children working in the stables, but she didn't see Jordan among them. One of the two children, a girl perhaps 12 or 13 years old, looked up as Carla approached and tugged on the robe of one of the monks.
Can we help you, mistress? The man said.
Well, I'm looking for Jordan, actually, Carla told him. I was told he was working here this week. The girl next to the monk giggled. The monk smiled at the child and gently turned her back to her chores.
That is true, mistress. Jordan was here at dawn, but he completed the chores I set before him, and he has left. He said he had a research project in the registry.
Carla smiled. That's exactly the project I wanted to speak with him about. I'll look for him there. Thank you.
May your work bring you closer to the father, the monk said, giving her a short bow before returning to his own labors.
Carla turned to leave, but paused, seeing two figures in white walking up the path toward Midgate, and she recognized them immediately. Kelisandra Fletcher, with the acolyte Padraic at her side. They were keeping their voices low, but Carla's hearing was sharp enough to listen, and she understood their Terrandin perfectly well.
Need to be watched closer than the others, Kelisandra was saying. Somewhat behind his eyes there is.
As you say, ma'am, Padraic said. Both Donal and Liam swear his wound was real, though. Said he was but a day from the final muster. Triad wouldn't have chosen him if he was false.
Perhaps they didn't choose him. Already one great deception here that we know of. No reason there's no second.
Padraic nodded at that, keeping silent.
Remain vigilant, Kelisandra instructed him. And remember, under the sun's gaze, all lies melt away.
Praise the sun. Padraic intoned automatically. And the other two with him? The girl and the old man?
Equally guilty, whatever they're about. All three must be watched. Pass the word.
Padraic nodded.
Aye, mum.
He spat into the grass on the side of the path.
Triad reborn, indeed.
Carla watched them pass, remaining where she was until they had passed into Middlegate.
What was all that about? Something about one of these blessed? Sounds interesting, but I've got no point of reference to get a clear picture.
She left the stable, heading for the registry.
Like as not, she's here to see the abbot. I should let him know what I overheard the next time I see him. He might be able to make better sense of it.
When she entered the registry, Jordan was sitting alone behind the long desk, a stack of old volumes next to him, a pair of cloth gloves on his hands. Behind him, she saw a monk coming back from the weapons locker, pocketing the key.
Can I help you, mistress?
Actually, Carla said,
I came down here looking for Jordan. I was wondering if I might be able to help him with his research project.
Jordan looked at the monk as he came up to the table.
Brother Renard, would that be all right?
Renard smiled.
I don't see why not, he replied, patting the young man on the shoulder. Come find me when you're done, so I can lock up behind you.
Thank you, brother, Jordan said as the monk left.
Did you see Kalisandra and Padrick as you came down?
I saw them, but only from a distance, which is just as well. I'm quite content to keep our interactions to a minimum. Is she here to speak to the abbot again?
I assume so, Jordan replied. At least with her around, Padrick wasn't so much of an ass when they came in here to drop off their weapons.
Thank the father for small favors, Careless said with a smile.
So, how goes the search?
Not too far yet, the young man admitted. This is the first chance I've had to start looking for the name, but I'm glad for the help. I thought you'd be with Captain Grievous in the archives.
Actually, Grievous took Wick with him this time.
Has he agreed to an interview?
Yes, but only after we find the name, and if Strabo did give an interview, then Grievous wants to read that as well.
Jordan nodded as if he'd expected such a condition, then gestured toward the stack of registries.
You said this fellow Strabo might have come here around 30 years ago?
That's not very specific, so I've pulled down everything from 20 to 40 years back. I started with the oldest ones.
He reached into a box under the table and handed her a second pair of gloves.
Grab the newest and start looking. We'll meet in the middle.
Carla came around to Jordan's side of the table and pulled up a chair.
I went looking for you at the stables, but they said you'd already done your chores there.
She sniffed the air.
You don't smell half so much like the stable as I'd expect.
Oh, I left my boots up there, Jordan explained. The monks wouldn't appreciate the registry smelling of horse manure.
Very wise, Carla laughed.
She took the first volume off the stack and turned to the first page. The book looked very similar to the registry that she had used upon her arrival here, although the pages of this volume had aged to a rich golden brown. Most entries took up two rows. The top row listed the guest's name, the dates they arrived and left, and their place of origin. The second row, she saw, was filled in by another hand, but aside from recognizing names written with Malakan characters, the script made no sense to her.
What language is this? She asked Jordan.
Jordan leaned over to look at the page.
Oh, that's not a language, precisely. It's a form of shorthand developed by the monks. That second line is filled in by whoever worked with that particular guest after they've left.
They briefly describe what the guest was here to research, what they contributed to the abbey as payment, and the name of the monk or monks who worked with them.
I can read the names, so those are the monks involved, right? And contributions means money or an interview.
Or something else, Jordan added. We've had folk come here with crates of books, bequeathing them to the abbey as a form of payment.
He reached across her to the book, tapping a place on the page with a gloved finger. That symbol there indicates the guest paid with money, and, he moved down several rows, here's the symbol for books. And below that, oh, here someone donated some exotic plants for our greenhouses.
What if they gave an interview?
Jordan scanned the page. Let's see, interview.
There's not too many of those. Most who come here have communicated with the abbey regularly through letters first and brought their entry fee with them.
Here's one.
He pointed to an entry with a mark Carla hadn't seen yet. It looked like an open arrowhead, or a right triangle turned to one side, the point facing left.
That symbol represents an open mouth, meaning the client spoke to us. An interview.
Oh, I see. All right, I'll get started.
I'll still get to interview Captain Grievous even if you find the name, right?
Carla laughed.
Of course. I wouldn't be in here if you weren't already looking.
Reassured, Jordan returned to his volume of the registry. Carla did the same. After carefully checking each page for the name Strabo, she closed that book and picked up another one. Then another. She began to notice some patterns in the guests that came to the abbey. Their arrivals and departures had a yearly rhythm to them. Guests who came for shorter stays would arrive not long after the rainy season had passed and remain here for a few weeks, departing before the hot summer began.
but guests who came for longer periods of time would often arrive at the end of summer and the start of fall, then remain through the colder months and depart when the damp had passed. Like migratory birds, she mused, noting some scholars' names in the registry several years in a row. She kept an eye out for the name Stephen Kohaya, though she suspected the Duke would have traveled under a false name when he studied here. She glanced at Jordan, wondering if the Duke would have looked like him back then. Well, he wouldn't be in this volume anyway, she judged. These entries are from about 20 years ago, and he's been ruling for 25. Maybe he's in the next one. Then, in the middle of the page, an unexpected name caught her eye. Carrick? She blinked and looked again, leaning in close. Dunstan Carrick! And two names under that, same entry. Aiden and Rose! The world seemed to slide away as she stared down at the entry, her mind struggling to comprehend what she was seeing. It doesn't have to be Teska, she thought. Carrick's not an uncommon name in Terrandor. I've heard it before. Could just be a coincidence. But she couldn't accept that. A separate set of Carricks traveling the Frieze at the same time Teska's family was, with the same names as Teska's family? No, it's got to be him. Jordan, she asked, if an entry has more than one name in it, does that mean the guest brought family with him? Jordan glanced up. They're indented beneath his name? Yes. Then they're probably his children, and young children at that. Otherwise they'd have their own entries. All right, thanks. She checked the date. 21 years ago. She felt a chill run through her and glanced around. Teska and his family stood in this room as their father entered their names in the book. How old would he have been then? 5? 6 at most. She tried to imagine what he would have looked like. A serious little boy with a short black ponytail and bright eyes, his back to the wall, studying the room. A smile came to her lips. No, that would be Teska as a little boy. This was Aiden Carrick. I bet he smiled a lot more, not knowing what was to come. Then she imagined who would be standing next to that little boy, maybe holding his hand. Rose, a year younger, but the same dark hair, maybe the same eyes too. The father she couldn't picture as anything but an older version of Teska, with tousled, graying hair and the short, full beard most Terrandon men wore. Why did they come here? Why didn't Teska tell me about it? She had to admit that perhaps her friend had simply forgotten. Teska did say he had lost track of all the ports and places they visited before sailing into the Empire. Returning to the entry, she paused, recognizing another name. The monk who worked with Dunstan. It's Walter Banbrook. The abbot? Well, I guess he wouldn't have been the abbot then, just Brother Walter. And there's his name again, beneath the next entry. Moira Delane, also from Terrandor. Wait, the dates for her arrival and departure match Dunstan's. Was she traveling with them? Teska never mentioned anyone named Moira. Aha! Jordan shouted, startling her out of her reverie. She looked up to see the young man beaming proudly at her. Tiberius Strabo. You found him, she said, scrambling out of her chair to stand next to Jordan. Her eyes quickly picked out the name. Captain Tiberius Strabo. He arrived 36 years ago and stayed for a week. She looked at the bottom of the entry, and her eyes widened with excitement, seeing the symbol she'd been hoping for. And he gave an interview. With help, Jordan confirmed. He pointed to an entry further down. There were 5 other Sabrians traveling with him, but you can see in their entries this symbol, which indicates that they were part of his entourage but didn't pay for access to the archives themselves, receiving only room and board. Then after them is this man, Pierre Tregabi, a Brevellan, and this mark here, he tapped the page, shows that he participated in Strabo's interview as a translator. I'd heard there was a translator with him. So, when can we get this interview? Grievous will want to read it as soon as possible. And so would I, to be honest.
Well, you can put in a request to have it brought up from the archives, Jordan told her. There's several other requests ahead of it, though, so it would take a few days at least.
A few days? Kerla arched an eyebrow, seeing something in Jordan's expression.
Maybe you could speed things up? You know the archives like the back of your hand. You could find it much faster than that, couldn't you?
Probably, the young man admitted, but I've got a lot of work ahead of me today. I only found the time to check the registry this morning by getting up early to do my chores at the stable. Then I have classes to attend until dinner, and after that, I'm tutoring two of the younger children on algebra in the evening.
Well, maybe you could do it after that, Kerla asked. Just one trip into the archives?
She saw him go very still and smiled.
You know how to get into the archives after curfew, don't you?
Even if I did, Jordan replied, evading the question. Then he shook his head and gave a low whistle, which Kerla thought was a bit too dramatic. But that's a big risk. I'd get in a lot of trouble if I'm caught down there. Kerla studied him, wondering at his behavior. Then she understood.
You're not balking at the idea. You're haggling over price.
Jordan grinned back at her.
All right, what do you want for this favor?
It's a big favor, Jordan said. I'm not kidding about how much trouble I'd get in if I was caught. If the monks found out that I knew a secret way into the archives, I'd probably be sent to scrub out the cisterns with a toothbrush.
I understand. So, what's your price?
Two things. One, Grievous gives me the interview even if I'm caught. And two, he leaned forward and looked Kerla straight in the eye. You tell me why you're really here. She blinked, not expecting that.
What do you mean?
Grievous is chasing after this fellow Strabo. I've put that much together. Given the time frame, I've even got an idea why. That long ago, there's only one Sabrian in the Frieze that anyone remembers, and he was a captain too. But you aren't here for just that. There's more, and I want to know what it is.
Kerla suddenly saw Jordan's resemblance to Duke Stephen. It's when he's sitting still, she realized, when he's serious. They have the same posture, the same slight tilt of the head when they look you in the eye and hold it. In that moment, she almost blurted out the truth, but she held back. I've got to tell him anyway, but I don't know how he'll take the news. Right now, I need him as he is, hungry for answers, eager to help.
All right, she agreed, but that's a big risk for me as well. So I'll have to raise my own price a little higher. Jordan grinned and leaned back, his father's likeness submerging beneath youthful energy.
Naturally. What's your counteroffer?
I go with you into the archives. I'm no stranger to sneaking around at night, as you've likely guessed, and I might be able to help you avoid being caught. And one thing more. She turned back to the registry she'd been looking at and pointed to the entries for Dunstan Carrick and Moira Delane. There's two more interviews we need to find.
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Frieze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.